So in the last class, we were discussing some of the characteristics of a yogi, as explained in the 17th chapter. Today, we are going to discuss the concept of yoga as expounded in the 5th chapter. 5th chapter deals with two types of yoga: the yoga of renunciation and the yoga of action. In fact, it begins with a question from the student, Arjuna. Arjuna asks one question: Sanyasam karmanam krishna punar yogam cha samsadi yat sreya etayoregam tanme bruhi sunischitam. This is the simple question which Arjuna puts before Krishna. I shall just give a background of these two concepts. Now you find in the characteristics of individuals, societies, nations, cultures, and civilizations, two different trends. Some cultures, some civilizations, certain societies are action-oriented. Some other civilizations are being, I don't want to praise them too much. If I say they're contemplation-oriented, it will be going too far, but then maybe little less action-oriented. That would be a much more impartial assessment. Now, and this you find among individuals also. Some individuals are hyperactive, ambitious, action-oriented. Some others are a bit of an introspective, a withdrawn type of personalities. Now, Arjuna is asking a simple question. Which of the two is superior? This is Arjuna's question. Here, contemplation implies an element of renunciation of action. And renunciation and a path of action implies a little less of contemplation and introspection. So normally in societies you find if a person is very active, ambitious, especially in more conservative societies in Asia and to a lesser extent in the conservative societies of Europe, in Middle Ages, those who are of a withdrawn type, more interested in scholarly pursuits, were supposed to be somewhat superior. I don't say it right or wrong, but this assumption was always there, but not so much in the United States, because after all, the United States came into existence as a revolt against all that is conservative, feudalistic, all those mummified, fossilized values and conceptions of medieval Europe. But you find in traditional conservative societies, those who are too hyperactive, too ambitious, were sometimes considered to be different and even inferior to those who were more prone to introspection, contemplation, and scholarly pursuits. Now, there are two types of introspection, two types of renunciation. One renunciation is voluntary renunciation, just giving up all activities. It could be due to laziness, lethargy, or mistaken identity, mistaken values. There is a higher renunciation that you find in the teachings of the great spiritual traditions of the world. In the Gita, maybe in the Bible, when Jesus Christ tells the people, I'm a merchant, you sell all you have got and follow me. Actually, this is a kind of renunciation that you find emphasized in all the major religions of the world, which have some element of mystical tradition. That's a higher renunciation, the way Buddha renounced his kingdom and comforts and spent his time in contemplation. That's a higher renunciation. That is not what actually is implied in Arjuna's question. Arjuna's question is very simple. Which is better, the path of action or absence of action the path of introspection. Now, Krishna's answer is, in ordinary circumstances, the path of action is better. Because except for a few chosen few, the path of renunciation sometimes involves an element of hypocrisy, duplicity, and, as I said earlier, mistaken identity. Sometimes there is a misunderstanding that renunciation of action and action proper are two things that we can choose from. It is not so. We have to evolve to a particular stage, and then it becomes naturally our path. So, we coming to the text proper, we will enter the text. So, Arjuna's question is this: Sanyasam karmanam Krishna punar yogam cha samsati yat shreya etayo regam tanme bruhi sunischitam. So, Arjuna's question is very simple. Which is better, action or performance of action or renunciation of action? Of course, there's a background for Arjuna's question. For that, we had to go back to the earlier chapters of the text. You know, Arjuna was facing a great dilemma. He was called upon to do something which was his sacred duty, which was actually his responsibility, and he wanted to get out of that action. The action became unpleasant because he did not like it, not because it was bad in itself, because he had done such things, whatever he was supposed to do in the Mahabharata, what he had done earlier. But here it was an action or a duty or a performance of responsibility which he found to be somewhat unpleasant. So he thought, I can choose one of these. As just as we go to a market, if you want to buy oranges, you can buy that. You can buy apples, you can buy that. We have a right to choose from. But Krishna's answer is, really speaking, in life, we do not have a choice. I should explain this. We think we have a choice. We normally do things which we really deserve to do. That's why, as I mentioned in the last class, there is always a conflict between what we want to do, what we would like to do, and what we normally do. What we normally do is what we deserve, and what we would like to do is very often something that we do not deserve, so we are not able to do that. We are not able to bring our mind to do certain things which our mind is not willing to do, though our intellect, our conviction, our noble thoughts would make us do, but mind is not willing to do. So the essence of Krishna's answer is, for a normal person who's normally active, because he cannot keep quiet even for one split second. Krishna says one context, Nahi kasi kshanamabhi jadu tishtati akarmakrta. Kshana means a split second. No one can remain inactive even for one split second. Even when we are sitting in an easy chair, contemplating, our mind is active, which means we are not, really speaking, inactive. So when we assume that we are inactive, what we mean is our senses of action and body are inactive. We do not mean that our mind is inactive. In other words, it is physically and psychologically impossible for anyone to be inactive, both mentally and physically at the same time. So action is our lot. There is no choice. Now, what is the best way out? This action can be sublimated. Normally, we do things in a very peculiar way. Whatever we do, we establish a link with that action, with the result that we that it produces. There is always a link, an inseparable link, between what we do and the result, the consequences that we want to achieve through that action. It is this link that creates problems, that creates anxiety, depression, and all other problems. In fact, that is the problem which was confronting Arjuna also. So, in fact, all the great prophets, mystics, all the great men the world has produced, whom we still remember, even thousands of years after their passing away, we remember because they did certain things without thinking much about the consequences, or without really bothering much about whether their action will benefit them or not. Can we really do anything without bothering much about whether the result will be beneficial to us or not? If we cannot do, we have not started spiritual life. Sri Krishna says the beginning of spiritual life is breaking this link between what we do and its immediate expected consequence. If you want peace of mind, is the only way to do that. So long as we do certain things, we do our duties with a definite motive, with a strong will, with our mind focused on the immediate benefit that it produces, we can never have peace of mind. Because our actions never produce the exact result that we want. It never happens. Either it should be above the expectations or it should be below the expectations. So it's a simple psychological fact. If we could always do things and reap the expected result, then there will be no need for religion, God, or mysticism of Gita lectures here. Everybody will be happy. And there will be no literature, no history, no painting, no philosophy. See, why? We will be only machines. We will become machines. We will become computers. A computer produces the exact result that we want it to produce. So it has no anxiety, but it's only a computer. So conflict is always a sign that we are trying to move forward. We are trying to progress in spiritual life. So Krishna says the first need is to break the link, the chain that binds our action with the result. That means we must learn to do things without much bothering about the consequences or the immediate material selfish benefits that our actions are going to produce. And that is called karma yoga, which Krishna calls it. That's why, you know, Krishna says in the second chapter, sannyasa karma yogascha nisreyasa karo ubho tayostu karma sannyasa karma yoga visishyade. This is the meaning. Meaning is simple. There are two parts. Renunciation of action. Here, renunciation of action doesn't imply renunciation of action of a Buddha or a Shankaracharya or a Vivekananda, the great, or a Jesus. Those, the great spiritual giants who renounced their social obligations, family obligations, because they felt a greater obligation to the whole universe. So their renunciation of their small obligation to the society, to their immediate kinsmen, was actually an acceptance of a greater obligation for the whole humanity. So that is the... But here, what Lord Krishna means is not a renunciation of these great spiritual giants. It is the natural tendency of a lazy man to avoid his responsibility because it's a bit troublesome. So, a lazy man may find justification for inaction in yoga. An active man may find a justification for hyperactivity. Both are wrong. That's what Lord Krishna says. So he says there's a gradual evolution from action to renunciation, but this is possible only by plunging deeply into the path of action. And for that, action should be combined with contemplation, which is called karma yoga. In fact, that is the meaning of yoga in this particular verse. So Krishna says, it is far better to do one's duties and responsibilities, to be in the midst of worldly responsibilities, and to practice action, but practice action along with contemplation, that is far superior to empty renunciation, meaningless renunciation by a man who is not a Buddha or a Jesus. That's a simple meaning here. So Lord Krishna's answer is this: it is always better to practice karma yoga, or to sublimate, to refine, to bring action to a higher level by combining action with contemplation, and then it becomes action and spirituality combined, which is called karma yoga. So yoga is better than meaningless renunciation by a person who is not fit for the highest contemplative life. That is the implication here. In fact, Swamiji in one context gives a very interesting picture of gradual evolution of a spiritual seeker from the grossest to the highest and subtlest level. At the grossest level, we normally practice rituals, external rituals, because external rituals is a way of giving a spiritual orientation to our natural tendencies of mind and the senses of action, because senses of action and mind are naturally active. We don't have to work hard to see an object or hear something, because mind and senses of action and senses of perception combine together and they naturally flow outward. Seeing, touching, smelling, hearing, and so on. Now, these tendencies should be given a spiritual orientation, Godward orientation. So instead of going for a walk in the open marina, if we enter into a place where meditation is going on, then walking is combined with some kind of spiritual orientation. People who are bookworms can keep themselves busy reading thrillers, maybe even P.G. Woodhouse. But then along with that, if they could read some spiritual books, then the reading habit is sublimated. People who are addicted to computers and YouTube or internet can sublimate that tendency by starting seeing great films of saints and sages that teach us spiritual values. So every action has got a scope for sublimation. So every action can be purified, refined, and sublimated, and then becomes action plus contemplation, which is called karma yoga. And that is certainly far better than doing nothing, remaining physically inactive, and mind being always busy with undesirable thoughts, ideas, and conflicting desires. So a very psychological answer is given here. In fact, Lord Krishna elsewhere gives a very interesting definition of who is a karma yogi and who is the opposite of that. In one context, she says, the one who physically withdraws himself from all actions, at the same time mind being full of desires for which he is not willing to act, such a person is hypocrite. Karmendriyani samyamya aste manasasmaran indriyartham vimudhatma mithyacharaha sauchi. Mithyachara means hypocrite. Means a person who says, well, I won't do anything, I'm not interested in action. I'm not interested in running a business. I'm not interested in working in a factory or an office. At the same time, is he meditating? Has he evolved to such a state? The state of a Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree? No. He's sitting maybe in the marina, watching everything, mind running right, full of desires. No. Krishna says, this is karma yoga, not karma yoga. This is karma yoga, means where action becomes a sickness because mind is hyperactive. Mind is revolting. At the same time, he thinks that he has gone beyond action. That is exactly what Arjuna was trying to do. So Krishna called him by a most uncomplimentary name called hypocrites. And then he says, elsewhere he says, who is a yogi? Saktaha karmani avidvam so yadha kurvandi bharada kuryan vidvam tatha asaktaha chigirshu loka sangraha. He said, the one who has diverted his mind to a higher spiritual goal, but remaining active all the time, no matter what action it could be, what profession he may be engaged in. It's like Vyatha, Mahabharata, we discussed in the last few sessions. A butcher who was busy cutting meat, selling those things. He was a yogi, he was a karma yogi. Because he was doing everything as his sacred duty and responsibility. In other words, he could break the link between what he was doing and the consequences. And the profit. He was not interested in the profit. That is, instead of being a family business, he was doing to make both ends meet. But didn't think much beyond that. So he becomes a yogi. So a person who forcibly withdraws his mind and senses of action and senses of perception and then thinks he has become spiritually evolved is a hypocrite. On the other hand, a person who is always active but combining that action with contemplation, which is called action and spirituality, is a real yogi. That's the implication here. There is an interesting verse in a very ancient book, Sanskrit book. That verse is very revealing in this context. The verse is this: Vanepi dosha prabhavanti raginam griheshu sarvendriya nigrahastapa. Agutside karmani yap pravartade nivarta ragasya griham tapovanam. So what is a forest hermitage? That is the definition. What is an ideal retreat? Retreat means a place where people who have withdrawn from all actions can spend their time in contemplation, in spiritual meditation. He says, a person, he may be a householder, he may be a monk, he may be a mendicant, who don't know who he is. A person becomes a yogi when he is free from all selfish desires. On the other hand, even if a spiritual seeker who has not sublimated, who has not transcended his natural cravings, his desires, if he goes to an empty forest where there is nobody, nothing, not even wild animals, that place itself becomes a marketplace for him. Because he may be sitting in solitude, inside a cave, in the midst of a deserted, in an empty forest, but his mind will be always in conflicts because such a person will not be able to withstand solitude. Solitude will become a terrible torture for a person whose mind is not ready to enjoy solitude. So if anyone wants to test himself or herself, well, am I really ready for the highest life of renunciation and introspection? Can we sit in solitude and still enjoy peace and harmony without craving for the company of anyone, not even books or computers or films? Can he or she always spend his mind, keep his mind in union with the highest universal spiritual soul, that person is fit for renunciation. Otherwise, what happens, you know, his case becomes much worse than an average person. Very often what happens, when we withdraw from action or when we try to misinterpret our mind in the wrong way, and when we try to forcibly withdraw from action and try to force a contemplative life upon ourselves, we are blocking our natural path for spiritual progress. So Krishna says, first of all the senses of perception and senses of action should be refined, sublimated, and lifted to higher spiritual level by combining action with contemplation. So through this process, our mind becomes purified, our actions become purified, and gradually we become fit for the highest contemplative life. You know, Kalidasa was the Shakespeare of India, so to speak, and he lived in the 2nd century AD. He wrote many books. In fact, great German scholars like Schopenhauer and others, they were among the pioneers, the Orientalists, who introduced Kalidasa's works to the Western world. There is an interesting verse in one of his books. He says, Prajnasya Mudasya Kari Yogi Samattu Madhyebi Tanunna Buddhi. The meaning is this. You watch people in their action. Now, on the one side, we have a highly elevated spiritual person. On the other side, we have an ordinary person who has not done much spiritual practice. You're not interested in any of these things. Physical, if you judge them by their physical actions, physical movements, there is no difference. But the difference is only in their mind. Similarly, Lord Krishna says, the essence of Karma Yoga is elevating a mind, our mind, to a higher level while being engaged in our duties and responsibilities. So he says, it is far better to be an active person doing our duties and performing our responsibilities in this world than forcibly practicing a life of inaction. That is a statement here. In the third verse, Lord Krishna repeats the same idea much more forcibly. He says, Yeyasa nitya sannyasi yona dveshti na kamshadi nidundohi mahabahu sugam bhanta pramuchyadi. Now, who is a monk? Who is a sannyasi? Remember, the sannyasa, the word here used, means a monk or a mendicant. It's a technical word used here. The meaning of the word is one who are renounced. Renounced what? Not action. Renounced selfishness. That is a definition given by Shankaracharya, the commentator of Gita, and also Lord Krishna himself. So, the third verse says, he or she is the real mendicant who has no personal likes or dislikes, and who is completely free from hatred and its opposite, attachment, aversion and attachment. So the real sannyasi is the one who has transcended, who has given up the opposites of aversion towards one thing and extreme attachment towards the other. Here, we should remember one point. It doesn't mean taking everything the same manner. A real monk, a real man of renunciation or woman of renunciation will be completely free from prejudices. That's the idea behind. Prejudices in views and prejudices also in activities. He will be nidvanda, means free from twofoldness. Normally, our mind always operates from one pendulum, moves from one pendulum of the clock to the another pendulum. It doesn't stand in the middle. We are attached to something, extremely attached to something, or obsessed with something. It also means we are extremely hostile to something else. We can never be extremely attached to something without being equally averse, hostile to its opposite. So mind always moves in the world of these opposites. So transcending the pull of these opposites, the influence of these opposite feelings, is the essence of renunciation. But that renunciation, that exclusive contemplative life, is possible only by first going through the process of action. So, and one another point that is stressed is here is Sankhya Yoga Prithak Bala Prabhadantina Pantidaha Ekamapyastida Samyak Ubayoha Vindade Phalam. It's a very famous verse. Here Krishna makes an interesting statement. There are some people, as I mentioned early in the beginning of this class, there are some people who would say contemplative life is one thing, spiritual life is one thing, secular life is something else. Action is one thing, meditation, contemplation is something else. Or one is superior, the other is inferior. Lord Krishna says, this view is characteristic of people who do not have proper wisdom. The one who is established in one path reaches the goal attained by a person who follows the other path. Sankhya, the word means the path of contemplation, path of knowledge. To give an example, suppose we are not interested in any of the worldly achievements, worldly activities. If we can spend our whole lifetime in meditation, contemplating on what we really are, if we analyze our own personality and the external world, you find everything in the external world changes. And then the senses and mind that come in contact with the external objects, that also is changing. Mind is also in a flux. So behind these senses, mind and intellect, there should be one changeless reality. Who am I? That question. So Vedanta tells you that we are in reality Atman. As Vivekananda said, every soul is potentially divine. We are actually the immanent, all-pervading, transcendental reality, which is called Brahman or Atman. This is the path of knowledge, path of contemplation. And in fact, this was the path which was actually followed by all the great mystics of the world in their own respective religious traditions. The language used may be different. The vocabulary used may be different. So you find if you read the writings of the Russian mystics, if you read the writings of Eckhart, if you read the writings of the great sages like Narada, who wrote Narada Bhakti Sutra in the 2nd century BC, you always find so many things which are identical. Self-introspection, and then the relentless quest for the higher spiritual wisdom, and experience, mystical experience. Now, as I said earlier, this is the ultimate goal in all spiritual life, in all traditions. We start with rituals, then we go through the process of mythology, through the stages of mythology, theology, philosophy. Ultimately, when we reach the level of experience, we understand this is the goal. This is the ultimate goal in all religious spiritual traditions. Now, this is the highest path. This is the path of yoga, Sankhya or knowledge or contemplation. The other path is yoga. Yoga means the path of action combined with contemplation, which is the path for all common people, which can be practiced by anybody in this world. But as I said earlier, the first requirement is we must try to do certain things without thinking about the immediate practical benefit of that action. In other words, utilitarianism is the worst enemy of spirituality or yoga. Utilitarianism and ultra-pragmatism. If we cannot think beyond utilitarian value and practical benefit of whatever we do, we can never start spiritual life. We can never understand, even intellectually understand, the first lesson of yoga. The first lesson that yoga teaches is we must break this chain, this link between what we do and the immediate result that it produces. If we can keep our eyes away from the result of our actions, then at individual level, we can reduce anxiety, hypertension, and other problems. At the same time, we can enjoy peace of mind within. So this path and the path of contemplation ultimately take us to the same goal, the highest spiritual realization. That's the judgment of Lord Krishna. So these two yogas, these two paths, the path of knowledge and the path of action, the yoga of knowledge and yoga of action, both can take us to the same goal. As I said earlier, there are two broad streams in civilizations and in cultures. One stream is related to action, the other trend is related to contemplation. There is a mistaken view that the path of contemplation is superior and different from the path of action. Lord Krishna says, action and contemplation are the same. Both can take us to the highest spiritual goal. If we can combine action with contemplation, then it is as much a path leading to the highest spiritual goal as contemplation itself. Now, in the next verse, Lord Krishna makes an interesting statement. That's the idea is repeated in the fifth verse, that is, the path of contemplation and path of action both take us to the same goal. In the sixth verse, there is a statement. Why is it that Lord Krishna recommends the path of action and contemplation, combination of action and contemplation for the common people? The answer is found here. Sannyasastu mahabahu dukkham aptum ayogataha. Yoga yukto muni brahma na chirena adhigacchati. The meaning is this. The path of renunciation of action is difficult for one who has not gone through the path of action. So this is a simple psychological fact. As I said earlier, the natural tendency of every human being is to act, not to remain inactive. As I said, our eyes, ears, and other different senses of perception, and also the five senses of action, are always dragging the mind towards external objects. So whatever we see, that experience creates a ripple. It registers a memory in our mind. So mind is nothing but a huge bundle of memories, sensations, and impressions gathered by the mind in association with the five senses of perception and five senses of action. This is a natural tendency. Now, can we forcibly drag the senses away from the objects? As I said earlier on one occasion, whenever we try to forcibly withdraw our mind from an object, the mind will naturally go to that object. As I mentioned earlier, there is no better example than the example of the bald-headed man. Because that's why often we have to quote it. See, a man found that he was losing hairs, and he met a doctor, maybe in ancient times, an alternative physician, Ayurvedic physician, maybe. And he recommended, well, you should never think of an egg. Because when you think of something, there is a tendency for you to become that. That is true. If you just watch the characters of youngsters, the university students, when they take the San Francisco Chronicle the first day morning, when they see the huge pictures of 7 foot football players, many of them want to be like that. And then they start practicing, they start going to gymnasium, and they start playing, and they want to become like that. So whatever we contemplate on, whatever we think on, whatever we fix our mind on, we become that. We may not become exactly like them, but we may, in India, in a country, in many of the European countries, and in Asian countries, where the cricket is very popular, small children will keep the photo of a big football cricket player and start practicing in the drawing room. So they want to become like that. So whatever we admire, there's a tendency for us to become like that. You have heard of Napoleon. Napoleon was a small boy. He was below the average size of any European, you know. So in Corsica, his mother was taking him for a stroll, and a small platoon of French soldiers were marching in the street, and the captain was shouting orders to the soldiers, and they were following. For some time, the captain stopped. Then Napoleon is a small boy of 5 years old. He also shouted the same order. And the soldiers suddenly started, they responded to Napoleon's, he's a small boy. Then that captain recognized something in Napoleon. This boy should be trained to the French military academy. And he was trained and he became one of the greatest military strategists and tacticians in the world. So he shouted the same order in French and the soldiers responded. Because in his mind, he was a great admirer of the military culture, militarism of those days. So whatever we try to do, whatever we admire sincerely, that we try to become, and many of us become that. So what is meant here is, when we try to contemplate on a great spiritual ideal, naturally we become that. So Lord Krishna says, these tendencies should be sublimated. To go back to the story, you know, the physician, the doctor said, you should never think of an egg. But that man, from that moment onwards, was struggling not to think of an egg. But he was always trying to avoid thinking about an egg, which means he has to think about it. And he went completely bald in no time. So, that's a story, maybe a very interesting story. So whatever we admire sincerely, we naturally become that. When we admire sincerely a great scientist, a student studying physics, if he really becomes a great admirer of Einstein, there is every chance that he may become a professor of science. There's every possibility. So the point is this, Lord Krishna says, we can never really, forcibly withdraw the senses and mind from external objects. It is impossible. Then then how to combine action with contemplation? He says, you direct these senses and mind towards spiritual ideas. Mind needs some food. It is always seeking food. And if you don't give mind good food, it will eat bad food. And if it eats bad food, it will fall sick. So very often, this is a problem we are facing in today's world. Sometimes parents and teachers criticize children for watching computers and TVs. Instead of criticizing, we can tell them, you watch computers, but you can watch these wonderful things also. There are many wonderful things, spiritually elevating movies, ideas, literature available in computers and TVs. Those things will have a spiritually elevating impact, effect on our mind. In fact, that's a psychological technique that Lord Krishna recommends here. If we should divert, we should give a Godward orientation to the mind and senses. We cannot start with mind, because mind is subtler than senses. Eyes go in one direction, and then only mind goes there. So mind is subtler, but eyes, ears, all these are comparatively gross entities. So we can forcibly try to do things with the five senses of perception and action. Seeing good things, hearing good things, and coming in contact with good persons. All these will help us to give a Godward orientation to mind. And that will train the mind to combine action and contemplation together. In the famous classic Bhagavata Purana, there's an interesting discussion between nine sages and a wise philosopher king. He asked many questions. Nine sages visited a great king. Kabiravi Andariksha Prabuddha Pippalayanaka Avir Hotrodha Chamasas Chamasap Karabhajanaka. Nine sages, I need not give the list. Kavi, Revi, Andariksha, Prabuddha, Pippalayana, and so on. They came to this prince. So when they came to him, he asked one question. In fact, he asked nine questions, in fact. Each question to each one of the nine sages who visited him. One question was, how to live in this world? How to practice spirituality while living in this world? So first, the sage called Antariksha, he said, he first explained the state of a highly evolved spiritual person. He is one who sees God in everything, and he sees everybody in God. For him, there is nothing in this world other than God. So everything that he sees, that he experiences, that he comes in contact with, reminds him of God. And when he thinks of God, he also can see the whole humanity within God. This is the highest state of spiritual experience. But then he said, this is a very high state. See, suppose we read scriptures, we meditate in the temple or a church or what, wherever maybe, synagogue, anywhere, or Buddhist meditation centers. But when we come out, there is a conflict. So within the meditation room, when we are listening to lectures, our mind is in one world. When we come out, when we see people, when we interact with people, when we have to do things which perhaps many people may not like to do when they live spiritual life, there is a conflict in mind. How can I combine both? So Antariksha, this great philosopher, this sage, gives one answer. He says, Ishare tadadhineshu balisheshu dhitasuja prema maitri kripa upeksha yakkarodisa madhyamaka. He is here speaking about the average spiritual seekers, like many of us. Because when we go to meditation halls, when we read scriptures, when we do worship, we are in one world. But when we come out, when we go to business, when we go to factories, when we go to our regular workplaces, we are coming in contact with a different world. So how to solve this discrepancy, this dilemma? So he says, you should have devotion to God, and then you should have compassion for those people who do not know much about spiritual ideas, but who would like to learn from you. You should try to help them, and you should try to teach them. At the same time, you should always try to mix with spiritually elevated souls and discuss. Whenever you meet your fellow spiritual seekers, you should discuss spiritual ideas. Maybe what we read in a book, what we heard in a lecture, or some ideas that we may have heard recently from a book or any source. So first, We must have a great devotion to the spiritual ideal. Then we must have a compassionate attitude towards those who are interested in spiritual life. And then we must try to mix with fellow spiritual seekers and discuss with them spiritual matters. And still much more important than these three items, we must keep a long distance from people who drag us away from our spiritual path. We should not fight with them. There are many people who tell you, well, these are all absolute, these are utopian ideas, nothing, not of much practical value in this world. There are many people like that, you know, say, who cannot break the chain that between what we do and its immediate beneficial results. So such people may come and try to create doubts and conflicts in our mind. They may try to drag us away from our chosen path. We should not quarrel with them, because quarreling also keeps the mind attached. Quarrels also is an attachment. At the same time, we should not befriend them. If we try to become their friends, if we try to reform them, they may reform us from our path. So we should keep a long distance. Vivekananda in one context uses this term, indifference. Very interesting expression he uses. So in this manner, one can give a spiritual orientation to all the five senses of mind and five senses of perception, five senses of action, and gradually the mind. Give a spiritual orientation. Mind is full of all kinds of tendencies, good and bad. So we must keep on feeding the mind with more and more good tendencies through good actions, good activities. That will help us to combine action with contemplation, which is a natural royal highway for the majority of spiritual seekers in this world. And he says, this path can take us to the highest spiritual goal reached by the great spiritual seekers who choose the path of complete contemplation and introspection. Now we'll continue in the next class. If we have got anything to discuss, we'll discuss. We have got just a few minutes, 5 minutes, and then we'll conclude. Any points for discussion? You are free.
I have a question, but it's from chapter 4. Is that all right?
Yes, okay. Yes. The verse is this: Karman nyakarmaya pasyet akarmanicha karmayaka sa buddhiman manusheshu sa yukta krishna karmakrita. The meaning is this: the one who sees inaction in action and action in inaction, he is a wise man, buddhiman, yuktaham and yogi, and is the one who does everything. Now, this is the state of the highest spiritual, highest illumined spiritual person. The one who has transcended action and inaction both. Because they do everything, but they know that their real I is Atman, not the body. So Atman is not engaged in any action. Even when they are engaged in activities 24 hours of the day, 7 days of the week, still they feel our true I, true identity is Atman. And that Atman is beyond any action. And because it is beyond action, it is beyond inaction also. So in everything they do, they feel, I am Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman, I am the Atman. That feeling is there. Now again, the other part. And this is the method of seeing inaction in action. How to see action in inaction. Now, suppose they are doing nothing, which is called absence of action. If there is no action, how can there be absence of action? So even if they are sitting quiet, they don't feel they are not doing anything. Because the very idea of action and inaction is transcended. They transcend the realm of action and also the realm of inaction. This is the highest state. See, again, Give an example. In the Mahabharata, there is a story. A great sage was crossing the wanted to cross the river, and he had a heavy meal. And then he said, "If I had not eaten anything, let this river make way for me." The river made way for it. What do you mean? When he said, "If I had not eaten anything, I," he meant Atman. It's a high mystical state. If I have not eaten anything, after a heavy meal, 18-course dinner, he was saying, "If I have not eaten anything, let this river make way for me." And the river did make way for him because he meditated, "I am the Atman." And then he said, use the word, "I." Yes, no, Atman doesn't eat or drink water or have dinner or breakfast or anything. Only the body has it. So with that identity, he made a declaration. The same thing you find in the context of Shuka, who was a great sage of Mahabhagavata, you know. When he was born, he was a born jnani, man of total renunciation and total realization, knowledge. So his father called him, and then all the trees and mountains and valleys and rivers answered, because the sage has identified himself with the whole empirical world. So when his father called him Shuka, the whole universe answered, responded. So that is a high state of mystical experience, which often when they live in this world and when they are engaged in different activities, they come down several steps from that state of mystical experience of total unity between the individual and the cosmic consciousness. So we'll conclude today. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna.